and welcome everybody on this lovely sunny afternoon. Big thank you to Arts Council England and the Friends of Ledbury Poetry Festival, and this wouldn't be possible without them. I have great pleasure today in introducing Mark Waldron and Matthew Cayley. Mark has had three collections published. One is Brand New Dark and one is Itchy Sea by Salt. And Meanwhile Trees, which has just come out this spring from Blood Axe. And he was named as Next Generation Poet in 2014 by the Poetry Book Society. And Matthew's collection, Thirst, won the Forward Prize for Best First Collection. And his other collections are Scene of My Former Triumph, from Wrecking Ball and apparently from Blood Axe, but today he'll mainly be reading from his fifth collection, Rake, from Blood Axe, which is at the back available to buy at the end. And so if you give a warm welcome to both Matthew and Mark. Thank you.
Welcome to Disneyland. It's hot in my suit, and I can't scratch my itch with my fat white fingers. And when I breathe in here, I can smell the smell of last night's beer and of Minnie. She's standing over there. Sometimes I think she looks at me with her unblinking eyes and her fixed smile. So what we're going to do, I'm going to do 15 minutes of poems, and then Matthew's going to do 15 minutes, and then I'm going to do another 15 minutes. We're going to divide it up into four sections. This next poem is a poem from my most recent book, and it's a poem that I have this rule that I never talk about my poems before I read them, because I've discovered that what people's misinterpretations of what I'm trying to communicate are always massively more interesting than what I'm actually trying to communicate. So for that reason, I never really try not to talk about what my intention was. But this poem, someone said to me, a poet friend of mine said, Mark, why do you never write poems about yourself and about a kind of, you know, you as an I character? And I thought, that's weird, because actually all my poems are about myself. It's just I dress up as different characters, dogs or women or whatever. But I thought, okay, I'll try and write one which is a little bit more straightforwardly about myself in some way. All my poems are advertisements for me. When I was young, there was nothing exactly stupid about the world. In fact, in the good old days, there was the thump and the tug of it. The way it heaved itself like a stone, yanked, so to speak, in glory. The way it fell up, crushed up, and then crushed up again, getting newer and newer, louder and sweeter. The way it watched its own face fall between its fingers as though its face were a handful of gold coins. I think I might have known the whole drag of everything going upwards, a tide that pulled me with it. Actually, I know I did. You were part of all this, by the way. And the sky, well, where to begin? The sky was so adult, not imbecilic, or thin, or so-so, or girlish. Did I outgrow it? Did I drink it, shoot it, find a way around it? Did I get inside it and drive off in it? Forgive me. But on my way to work this morning, even though the sun was on fire and the trees were up, I was in the apocalypse. Death is not what you think it is. It's actually what I think it is. This poem's got some nipples in it, I'm afraid. It's quite early in the day, maybe. It's called The Uncertainty Principle. I wouldn't swear to it, but it seems to me that light owns the surfaces of things, dotting them indiscriminately with its capricious particles. Pock, 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 pock. Each is a paintball pellet, which, on splatting, contributes to colour up the ravenous darkness, rendering it fit for purpose, that purpose being to be seen. I admit I memorised whole portions of you, and under various lighting conditions. There were particles everywhere, an embarrassment of riches. You held out your hands, palms up, and you smiled at me as they rained down on you like dolphins. I find it very hot, the way particles can exist so saucily in two places at once, don't you? Your nipples, if I might say so, have something of that quality upon their quantum hooters, pock pock. I would shut out my black mouth if I could. Not everything is explicable. Exemplar, I know what I mean, or I think I do. Does my voice sound weird? I've got a terrible cold.
It sounds so weird.
Does it? I had a feeling. This poem's called The Chocolate Car. The little chocolate car has no wheels or windows and a body shell that's a sweet wrapper. Everything inside the car is made of chocolate. The engine, the battery, all the little pipes and cables, the petrol, the oil, the water, the brake fluid, the steering wheel and handbrake, the gear stick, the foot controls, the dashboard and carpeting, the seats and seat belts, the sweet wrappers in the door compartments, the driver and passengers, their flesh and blood and bones, their skin, their hair, the brains in their heads, the food in their stomachs, the feces in their bowels, the urine in their bladders, their clothes, the money in their pockets, and the dirt on their shoes, as well as absolutely all of the empty spaces in the car, are made entirely out of chocolate. The chocolatey smell that escapes from the car's body shell is the perfume worn by the chocolate woman who sits completely engulfed in chocolate in the chocolate passenger seat. She smiles to herself with chocolate lips over chocolate teeth in a chocolate mouth that's crammed full of chocolate. She smiles because she can sense that she's pregnant with an embryo that's a minuscule, errant, miraculous bubble of air. In my most recent book, there's a character. There are just three poems about him, and he's a professor of Renaissance literature or something. But he's also a hydrofoil. Do you know what a hydrofoil is? It's like those boats that raise themselves up. And this is one of the poems about him. It's hard to see Hamlet as some kind of everyman, bellows old Professor Hydrofoil above the sound of his own engine's biscuity shout as he skims across the pale Baltic waters lit with light. The sky is crazy for him, his riveted body, all chrome fuselage, instant abdomen, and what looks from here to be a thing like kindliness. He is, in fact, so shiny, so polished by his mother's early love, that we can see ourselves reflected in his tubular skin. We can see our bent smiles, which are the floaty grins of children who hold their parents' hands and watch the happy dogs that run through parks throwing off their ridiculous beards and laughing, laughing, laughing. But wait, Prof. Hydro has gone and got all serio. He's docked himself in a study in an old house in Palookaville. He's donned huge human clothes. He looks out onto a cold, wet street with the fallen leaves of trees stuck on it. The arrangement of the threads in his tweed jacket is such that that arrangement's own woolen heart is broken. There's nothing on the radio because it's switched off. Oh, how I'd love to own a pair of those long-toed clown shoes. I think I'd find myself so engaging in them. I'd put them on, sit down upon a chair, reach out my legs and happily behold my oddly shod feet. I'd stand and slap their long lengths on the ground to generate a flapping sound like a crack, crack. And then I'd hurry up to see you. I'd hurry backwards up the stair to show you my two new shoes. And you'd turn around and apprehend myself emerging up from them. A genie drifting from its polished lamp, a plant sucking at its just watered ground. The dead are helpless. You can do exactly what you want to the dead. You can call them filthy names. You can put your uncovered arse at them. You can stick them in the eye or spit on them, and still nothing bad will happen to you. You can drag the dead outside into the street, and there you could piss upon them. You could beat one even further into death with a brick, and no one can point the finger at you. And if they do, you can tell them to fuck off and mock their squeamishness by blubbing like a baby in mimicry of the feebly sensitive. It occurs to me just now that you might also want to stand as stiff in a doorway, have it held in place by means of ropes, and then with all your vehemence slam the door against it, hear it greet the dead's unwincing face just before it bangs against the jamb. You can always confound the dead. You can act like you're going this way and then you can go that way and punch them and they'll just stare up at the ceiling with that emptied look of theirs, emptied as an egg is from its shell. And the dead have nothing at all to use against you but your horror at their passivity, which looks sometimes so like the unresisting sweetness of your own poor martyred soul. I'm just going to do one more in this bit. No more Mr. Nice Guy. This then, what you actually witness here before your very eyelids is an actual blooming waste of time in action, in real time. I squid you not, certain, shall we say, people, with a certain, shall we say, cheek, have had a go at me about punctuality and punctuation, specifically the use or otherwise of ampersands and obscenities and rubbish and whatnot, as well as my peculiar drinking and poking fun at people with or without disabilities and so on. Well, from now on, from the very next thing I do onwards, I'll do exactly as I blinking well please, which is to be marvellously wretched and frightened, and broken, and hidden. Thank you.
Supposedly, the cooled silver birch bowl, barely 2 hips width, shudders like a woman on the brink of believing in her man. They are 2 rivers running into each other, clarities fusing fast, where Cold Harbour Lane runs out into Camberwell Green, the confluence of the Elbe and the Upper. So, as baneflower proliferate, cinquefoil and cress, or silt build scum upon scum, still they run on sieve-panned, and, as prospectors bent for what wild seam of beryl, jasper or jade jet-streamed, might yet convert bedrock into discarded jewellery. 2 rivers, 1 back, spine glint as a string of bulbs, 2 Pilsner Urquells kinked, their quart-strewn gravel beds groan as the waters withdraw. I fly, later slip the Ritzy and Relton Road to smoke the cool lips off Bathsheba, moonwashed awry, realigned tank top, overhead lamp lipped. Overhead tank top. I fly, later slip the Ritzy and Relton Road to smoke the cool lips off Bathsheba, moonlit awry, rear-line tank top, overlap of leaf against leaf, veined light, long-legged fly floats arced, stilt stanced on garlic bulbs stippling estuarial banks. Found a copy of Roy Fisher's The Download Drop in the gutter outside of bookmongers, leaf mulch, sailboat headed elsewhere or as the confluence of the Elbe and the Upper. Them sank in couch grass, dew-nipped, swollen, bare-assed, blocked, tributary where shyness meets shyness and forms a pane of glass. Breath, swipe, swipe. His sly cigarette, her furtive stretch for a book, nipple smudge night smock, Milan Kundera's slowness, modernism gone, with it the confluence of the Elbe and the Upper. This book is called Rake, and when you put a book out, the not an erudite audience like yourselves, but other people in the pub say, what's it about? And then you tell them what it's about, and then they start talking about the about, and they forget about the poems. But you have to put an about out, so you've got 3 choices of what this book is about. A, it's about an immortal time-travelling rake who is searching for his one true beloved through a heroic succession of amorous encounters, desperate to get beyond appetite. And the time-travelling is involuntary. It's like a neural twitch. Or B, it's about a whole pack, which is the proper collective noun for a pack of rakes, who are doing the same thing. Or C, it's about an ordinary guy who, having drunk 3 treble espressos in quick succession, believes himself to be time traveling. So now you've got that fixed, everything else will be plain sailing. We go back to Brixton. This is called Foregone Conclusion. Half inching, then dropping down the turquoise pale dolphin studded drainpipes of the Hotel Pimondin, escaping Baudelaire's crazy demi-mondaine, who is pelting me with gemstones. I unaccountably land at the back of Beehive Place, Brixton, 1987, 2 dealers stepping forth from their wall niche to intone, how's about something beautiful to help you stay the same? I trade a gemstone and the deal is done. Later will find me prone on a South London curbstone, some lacrimose nose-ringed fly girl battering at my breastbone with little fists, ahead of the foregone conclusion, my rare heart bursting like the sun, mind half inching up the turquoise pale dolphin-studded drainpipes of the Hotel Pimondin, tapping at the cracked window, hoping to get back in. There was a critic, American critic, called Guy Davenport, and he talked about the idea of originality was a very 20th century phenomenon, generally in art and poetry, very loosely before that. It wasn't such a great thing. And 99.9% of this next poem is are not my words, if we ever own words at all. They're taken from the inestimable epistolary novel La Liaison Dangereux by Chodorus de la Cloche. Don't ask me to say that sentence again, particularly after I've had some of your beautiful cider. I wouldn't be able to say it. So I think I changed 1 word possibly to get a word order. and it kind of comes out as a sonnet. It's called Written Immediately on Waking. But first, let me tell you about my gaucherie between laurel and myrtle in the great enterprise where tyranny is adored and the unconsolable spouse is keeping her word on the arms of this great spindle shanks, surveying her injuries, imagining a pride, or at least being able to recognize a profligate soul of the side roads, this footman who changes into chambermaid chic or reads Crebillon Fils's licentious novel La Sofa. How perfectly suited to being a lover. We had 6 hours together, folded but unsealed in a trough of sleep or panegyric. Oh, mademoiselle, knowledge of your weakness is my leisure. Poets don't earn much money, so thank you for paying to come and see us. It's fantastic. And Ledbury pays. You've seen all the scandals in the paper. Ledbury pays well, so that's good. But we always have to have sidelines to be able to keep going. So I've tried various things, and my last attempt was to launch a perfume. And I thought, well, Beyonce has done it, and David Beckham has done it very successfully. I thought I'd launch a poetry-themed perfume. I was a little discouraged with the sales. It was called The Smell of Charles Bukowski. Didn't seem to go so well. But I've got new hope. I've got a new idea. I've designed an app. That's the thing to do to make money. There's an app for everything now, so I've designed an app. Very specific what this app does. What it does is it gives you a genuine paper cut when you're reading a novel on Kindle. Strangely enough, there's a paper cut and La Liaison Dangereuse in this next poem. It's called Misery Memoir. Have just finished La Liaison Dangereuse by La Cloche, the book's edge pink as litmus. A paper cut to be run through by a flyleaf, this seep of blood, this plotting with a life never fully known. Am laid out on this heavy hung four-poster with Madame de and Madame de, mounting the very roster of their names, their restless petticoats chime with a riotous blossom outside. Exhaustion is a form of exhilaration, witness the last of any decaying nation. His full name was Pierre, Ambrose, Francois, Chodlerus de la Cloche. Even reading it aloud could lead one to exhaustion or a total lack of will to ever finish a novel or anything built to last. Excuse me while I ply my slit finger with elastoplast. The book doesn't have sections. I don't really like sections in books. It's great with other people. I don't really do it. But it's kind of, in some ways, the first half is kind of mirrored by some of the poems in the second half. And that poem, Foregone Conclusion, the second one I read, is in a sonnet string, which kind of veers between Paris 1848 and Brixton in the 1980s and back and forth. And there's another sonnet string in the second half of the book, which more kind of possibly lyrical or pastoral in old terms, and they're all named after trees. But it's not so much about trees as possibly they seem. This one is called Willow. If you've ever felt the fallout from an arc of welding sparks or bent to a burst of fireworks, then you may be able to show a touch more sympathy as to what it must be like to lie in its filtery lee by the boating lake of the shabby municipal park, doing nothing, almost blissfully. But I know you haven't, and therefore won't, and lack the gift of telepathic empathy. You disappoint me. They have bent towards water through history since the days of the Ark, their leaves typically sad but soothing sparks. This one bends to a dank culvert and a concrete bulwark. A flask of filter coffee, the collected works of Percy, Bysshe, Shelley, who knew this one as a sapling, knew me. You might even see the mistletoe at its height if your lenses were in and it wasn't so dark. I'm going to do a cover version in each half. I like to read the work of other people, other poets. But it's good to read other people's work. It makes you think about your own. And this isn't even a poem by a poet, although I guess he was a poet. This is by an American songwriter called Townes Van Zandt, a brilliant songwriter, very itinerant musician. And I was halfway through the book and it had various other titles. Usually I know the title. This book I couldn't decide on the title. It was originally going to be called something like Favourite Love Poems. It'd be kind of like an anthology. And then it was going to be called As Any Lover Would. And I had a long ballad which had about 180 verses, like a Leonard Cohen song. And then that went by the wayside. And then My Hypothetical Lovers. But then I heard this Townes Van Zandt song called Rake. And about halfway through doing the book, and this song imagines a rake, that somehow the rake, through his activities, disturbs time, the normal laws of time. So it seemed like the perfect kind of ballad to go with the book and provide part of the title of the book. So I'll finish with this before Mark comes back on. I used to wake and run with the moon. I lived like a rake and a young man. I covered my lovers with flowers and wounds. My laughter the devil would frighten. The sun, she would come and beat me back down, but every cruel day had its nightfall. I'd welcome the stars with wine and guitars, full of fire and forgetful. My body was sharp and the dark air clean, an outrage, my joyful companion. And whispering women, how sweet did they seem, kneeling for me to command them. And time was like water, but I was the sea, I wouldn't have noticed it passing. Except for the turning of night into day and the turning of day into cursing. So look at me now. Don't think I don't know what all your eyes are saying. Does he want us to believe all these ravings and lies? They're just tricks that his brain's been a-playing. A lover of women. He can't hardly stand. He trembles. He's bent and he's broken. I've fallen, it's true, but I say unto you, hold your tongues until after I've spoken. I'd taken my pride in the pleasures I'd known. I laughed and said, I'll be forgiven. But my laughter turned round, eyes blazing, and said, friend, we're holding a wedding. I buried my face, but it spoke once again. The night to the day was a binding. And now the dark air is like fire on my skin, and even the moonlight is blinding. And now the dark air is like fire on my skin, and even the moonlight is blinding. Thank you.
This poem's called Confessional Poem. And it was in The Guardian yesterday, which was nice. Forgive me. I've been tempted to make use of dissonance in an effort to resonate. I've walked all over my principles in day-glow flip-flops. I've attempted to schmooze when I should have been rough and abusive. In the locked bathroom, I've allowed my id to goose my poor ego, scarring it mentally. I've papered over the cracks with more cracks to obtain a crack effect. I've admired the cut of my own jib, juddering stiff on a wester. I've planted weeds in other people's gardens on purpose. I've pretended my eyes are windows and got drunk in a room behind them. I pretended everything's just terribly droll and awful. it was weird listening to Matthew. I've heard him before and kind of noticed the connections between his book and my book, and I've read his book, but there are some really striking similarities which I hadn't really noticed before. There's a kind of rake-ish character in my most recent book who's called Manning. And more weirdly, he also exists in different time periods, historical time periods, sometimes within the same poem. There are a whole bunch of poems about him in the book. This is one of them. It's called Collaboration. It was 4 p.m. when Manning and I sat down to discuss the poem and his role in it. An imaginary wind buffeted and rattled the remote French farmhouse window like some sort of device, like a signifier of something trenchant and solemn. Manning said he was so excited by the prospect of the poem that he was actually rock hard, as he put it. And what about I set it in a hotel room and sought him out with a Latvian stripper and half an ounce of good quality gack? And with that, quite matter-of-factly, he pulled his Johnson out of his zoot suit pants to show me his predicament. His member, though my gaze, I can assure you, recoiled from it with more haste than a hand would from a hot coal, looked something like a monstrous jewel in the setting of the surrounding grey fabric of his trousers. Or like, perhaps, a misplaced floral buttonhole that would have seemed less offensive had it protruded from the suit's lapel. It appeared to me that its grotesque rudeness buzzed against its, dare I say it, rather feminine beauty with a metallic ringing sound. But perhaps that was merely tinnitus brought on by the stress of the situation. I'd never known Manning to talk or behave in this way before, and even though it soon came to me that he'd been suffering from concussion, having been hit full on the head by a lance in a jousting accident, and even though within a day or so he'd recover fully and return to his innately sensitive and feminist self, I still always felt a little wary in his company thereafter. For what I had heard and seen that afternoon must surely have lain dormant in him through all the time I'd known him. And perhaps since then I consequently feel a little less secure in the company of all my friends and acquaintances, as well, of course, as in the company of myself. I've always used the poet Roddy Lumsden to edit my books before I show them to a publisher or to an editor of a publisher. And he's kind of Scottish Presbyterian. And sometimes he's drawn my attention to the fact there are a lot of penises in my books. Maybe not a lot, two or three per book maybe. I've made a conscious effort to try and stop it. But I think, you know that thing where people say, do you try to think of something other than the purple elephant and you just can't? And I think maybe the effort to stop myself has kind of allowed it to continue in some way. This is a poem that entered my head since, it's a recent poem, since my last book. It's called Buddies. Sometimes I have wished my dong an impossible leviathan that protruded from with a person's girth from my loins where we'd be as conjoined twins conjoined. It would rise to my head height so that I might each morning as I lay in bed reach my arms around it, hug it tight, pressed against my belly and my chest, rest my cheek against its helmet-sized helmet and hold it thus, so that we might buttress one another against this world's stuffy opprobrium. I think this is a sort of cautionary tale poem. Yeah, and it's in the Ledbury anthology, I think, this one. Yes, I admit that I have ate that once cool and heavy egg that would one day have hatched a clever goose of gold. I cooked it in a pan until it smelted from a hard into a runny yolk, and then I promptly drank the molten yellow. I gulped it down, felt it start to burn away my tongue and gums and teeth, whose residue then blew away as smoke. I felt it coursing down my roasting throat, through the squiggle of my blistered viscera, all the way beyond my screaming shitter from which it oozed and swarmed and spread wet metal excrement about my seared balls and buttocks before it slowly made to thicken. And once I died of pain, then sometime afterwards I ate away my flesh and bone. I sank my corpse in acid till no bit of it remained, but just this shiny winding cast, this meandered single golden sprue that rises from its golden stand and displayed like this so well describes a fool. This poem's called, well, it hasn't really got a title. Some of my poems, I don't really do titles some of the time, and they just sort of run on, so it's hard to say it's called this, because it's a kind of run-on title. First off, take note of my bespoke rabbit folk. Pale, no meat on them. A transient enthusiasm as they burst from squiggly silos, nibbling, 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 liebling, nibbling. Then see how my consort bod escorts me in its tight suit like a goon. And look how I leaf so slowly through your autonomous scent in the labyrinthine library of your presence. This world is like edible earth to me. Edible, certainly, but full in the sense of crammed. Me, I am but a pin, sharp, slid into it, new. Or I'm old, a blunt socket that receives existence's three-pronged plug that sucks my polished electricity. I fill myself also like a dog fills its wallop. Me, I'm the national anthem of somewhere shaky. You're as neat as a particle. I don't particularly mean you to touch me exactly. So two more, one shortish one and then one very short one. I wrote this for some friends of mine who were putting together an anthology of magic spell poems. To turn one dog to one cat, you perhaps ought to go to the park at a convenient time of your particular choosing. You should find there what may be a dog, knowing it by its humour. Take it home. Then, fast on the ready table, siphon its yap. You can do this. Then, on the washed table, stick it with a shameful enslavement to mice. On cushions in the drawing room, make it to fathom, slowly and then quick, that it is not itself. Disconnect with a straightforward yank, its crush on booze and the chew of the meaty cigarettes and the grunt of the trundling ground. So, first ordain it a fish, cat being fished, dog being fished, and make sure to bend it as well to a pale dusty blue before you plead it, and if needs be, require it to black. And to show what you've done, make it to whistle itself, once if you like. So this is the last poem. Thanks very much for listening. It's called The Fire Hose. If I was, I don't know, walking down, say, a street, and I happened to come across a group of, I don't know, firemen, and they were fighting, say, a fire, then I might imagine, might I not, their fire hose to be a long and beige salami. And then I might imagine, might I not, that I could take a slice of that salami, that I could peel it of its ring of canvas skin, and then I'd have the lens, the freshest monocle, through which, if I held it to my open eye, I'd probably see a group of firemen with a cut hose shouting angrily. Thank you.
Acute hot knee. If I behold your rucked-up dress, revealing as it does one acute hot knee in all its bare-assed actuality, nothing is composed. My nerve endings blossom to a tree, its roots suffused by a pale and horny sun. For what divinely revealed knee has not sometimes sparked tercets or sestets even? And what sick man's mind, not fickle as an icicle, from melt to freeze, from freeze to knees? More even than the Nazarene knelt on the watercress of Gethsemane, bewildered to beg to be human. I keep the habit of hallucination as the amputee still feels pain in their missing leg. As red and white corpuscles cycle, recycle themselves inside me, I try in vain to outguess, yes, ultimate finality, your divine, acute, hot knee. That poem weaves in, we talked about originality before, weaves in some lines and ideas by Roland Barthes from his brilliant book, Fragments of a Lover's Discourse, and also some John Berryman lines, the American poet John Berryman, who was a fantastic poet who did a lot to dislocate syntax. He dislocated a lot of other things as well in his life, but he did a lot of dislocation of syntax. And he had one line about, I paraphrase, but we must not the divine knee readily forget. So that was a kind of working a kind of theme about knees. But because I've stolen from John Berryman, then I should put back. So I'm going to read a John Berryman poem. This is Dream Song number 14. You may know it. Sing along if you want to sing along. Life, friends, is boring. We must not say so. After all, the sky flashes, the great sea yearns. We ourselves flash and yearn. And moreover, my mother told me as a boy repeatedly, ever to confess you are bored means you have no inner resources. I conclude now, I have no inner resources, for I am heavy bored. Peoples bore me. Literature bores me, especially great literature. Henry bores me with his plights and gripes as bad as Achilles, who loves people and valiant art, which bores me. And the tranquil hills and gin look like a drag, and somehow a dog has taken itself and its tail considerably away into mountains or sea or sky, leaving behind me, Wag. In the second half of the book, this rake figure, if he is a rake figure, or if he's a he or a she, or whatever it is, seems like he's slightly more... in the first half, he's pretty dissolute. In the second half, he's pretty dissolute. But it seems like in the second half, he begins to maybe get glimmers after 2,000 years of ping-ponging around time and the world and numerous affairs, that other people exist and that they're quite beautiful and they have charm and they can appreciate them. This is just beginning to break through onto his consciousness. In real life, this poem was started up by a friend of mine, gave me a CD, and she said, you must listen to this, Matthew. Every track on it is brilliant. And I thought, nah, come on. And I put it on. Every track was brilliant. And it had various things on, lots of blues, Howling Wolf, which I loved, and Sunhouse, which I loved. And it had Gavin Bryars' fantastic Jesus's Blood Never Saved Me, which is a fantastic piece. And it had William Burroughs, you know, the great beat author, singing in a Marlene Dietrich type voice, singing Falling in Love Again, which is a pretty amazing thing to hear if you ever want to hear anything. But on it was a track. I thought I knew a bit about blues music. It was a track by a blues singer I'd never heard before. And she's mentioned at the end of this poem. And I was raised as a Catholic, but I'm a born-again atheist. but I almost converted here in this track. It's absolutely beautiful. So that was the kind of real life inspiration for this poem. It's called Absolute Gospel. As she breathes honey into rock, or the fragrance of magnolia petals onto a southern wind, what gets blown back are the husky salient details that would make any atheist talk as if all four gospels were burnt onto their tongue. Hoard a wondrous lack as the track ends and the train pulls out of that slow, licentious summer, has them instantly comprehend why this gilt, skinny white boy stands, armed only with a tack hammer, ready to take on thousands for a single note from blind Mamie Forehand. I guess if you're called blind Mamie Forehand, you have to go down in history somehow. She recorded somewhere in about 1924, very early on. She was worked in the plantations with her husband, and they performed together in the evenings. They wrote only four songs. He wrote two, she wrote two. There's one called Honey on the Rock. It's very difficult to get hold of it, but if you can, listen to it. It's shiveringly brilliant. Ezra Pound said that about poets, that the thing itself is always the adequate symbol. And my kind of version on that is that I like the thing itself to be an inadequate symbol, that it doesn't quite gel. So you pick something that you're probably not going to work with and try and go with it. This poem is called Walnuts. Then the heat wave flinched and the trees arched upwards as if replenished, when your brown eyes tried so haltingly to withhold a tear, and their surfaces pearled darkly for about one microsecond, then dried. You told me about your grandfather, walnut groves, graves, my duty to cave into need, to cave into beauty at any opportunity, but you flirted with the waiter and the five tines of your fork lit up the rude. Then that tear retreated. Your half-wipe could not have been lighter, though inside you were irrigated as if after a long drought by a dew so wet it would straighten out the wrinkles on a walnut to a tabletop. I would have you in a white vest, ravish you on that table covered in walnuts. Excuse me. I would be dishonest with you, but for the shimmering night and all propriety outlawed. There, that said. Are there any florists in the audience? Any florists in the audience? Not even in Ledbury? No? We've been reading this book, Rake, since December, doing lots of it, and I've asked at every reading if there are florists in the audience, and no one has ever answered affirmatively to that question. And I thought, you know, florists and poetry, flowers, they would be akin. I'm actually beginning to believe that florists hate poetry and that these empty seats would be filled because they've blocked off the two roads into Ledbury with interflora vans and are bullying people and thrashing them with daffodils or something. So I'm going to keep asking that question. We've got a lot of readings still about October, so I'm going to keep asking. Ledbury, you've let me down. Why I ask is this poem is called The Kiss, and there's a lot of poems in this Rake book which are formed out of tanka form, sometimes a single tanka, sometimes they become a stanzaic unit. And you all know you're an erudite audience, so you know what a haiku is. And the technical term for a tanka is a morbidly obese haiku. Yeah. So this poem is called The Kiss. This florist shop girl sneaking out for a quick fag, smoke you turning back behind her inside the shop to mingle with the petals. Okay, this is the last one. I'm going to read something that I always finish with. I think it's something that we all need, a Cold War communist love poem. And this poem is called The Young Hegelians. And it's not an academic thing at all. I was once in Nottingham with my sister when I was about 15 in the Cardoma coffee bar, and there were all these students from the university in black polo necks and smoking chitans and things and talking philosophy. And I heard the phrase, the young Hegelians. I just thought it was the most beautiful, I didn't know who they were or what they represent, the most beautiful phrase I'd ever heard. I wanted a T-shirt with the young Hegelians. I wanted to form a band, Matthew Cayley and the Young Hegelians. I wanted to go to sea with the Young Hegelians. It's so beautiful. So I've been trying to get the Young Hegelians into a poem for about 30 years, and hopefully I've finally managed it. And this is a twin, really, with the very first poem that I ballsed up in the first half, called The Confluence of the Elbe and the Upper. And they both share kind of rivers that don't meander where they actually meander. This is the final one, the Young Hegelians. Supposedly the river Neva disperses the waters of Lake Ladoga through the Gulf of Finland into the Baltic Sea and might be the site for a purge of leaders, looters in food halls, an awning frozen to a portcullis of icicles. We sat shiver still, discussing dialectic like any group of Prussian intellectuals, Hegel, a Hegel reader. We were either side of that chill sea, gin soda, grey interference, yet your eyes, black floor in green, green floor in black, made me thaw. Wind that could rend a windsock made your own voice seem as if coming through a vocoder, though you stood next to me, trying to sell some bootleg CDs to no one, Ect Phil Oakey, gone solo, produced by Giorgio Moroder, your eyes like sloes against snow. We knew history has no coda, but sings in our ears on shuffle, incessantly on shuffle, like wind through a cracked windbell. Knew the still never would disperse Ladoga's drift into the Gulf of Mexico, turn fumarole, make green vegetation steam. Later, warmed by the radio in your Skoda, you would show me the petrified shopping malls and beautiful on the open road police horse droppings frozen into snowballs. Thank you.